Okay, for those of you who don't know me, I am Jeff Stone. A little bit about me, since I guess I should introduce myself. I'm a graduate of the law school, 1971. After serving in Washington for a couple of years as a law clerk, I came back here in 1973 and joined the faculty, and I've basically been here ever since. I served for a while as dean of the law school and as provost of the university, but most of my career has been as a professor here. I teach primarily in the field of constitutional law, although like most of my colleagues, I occasionally teach around the curriculum, and this quarter, for example, I'm teaching evidence, and we tend to value that as a way of both keeping ourselves engaged in a wide range of subjects and also enabling us each to sort of know about new things so we can talk to one another as well as to you about things other than the small niche that we might otherwise tend to specialize in. I should also say that I'm going to be making this as a somewhat more formal talk than I think is usual for CBI talks, and there's really two reasons for that. That is, I'm using a text. And two reasons for that. One of them is that I gave a more extended version of this talk as a formal lecture at UCLA about a month ago, and since I had already prepared a text, it seemed silly not to use it. And second, as you'll see, I'll be invoking a lot of quotes, and for the sake of accuracy, it's probably better to actually use the words of the people I'm quoting than to make them up as I go along. So that also led me to err on the side of using a text. This talk grows out of a book that I'm currently writing with the working title Sexing the Constitution, which explores the intersection of sex, religion, and law. The work as a whole, and this small piece upon which I'll draw in this afternoon's talk, is at least potentially relevant to many constitutional issues, including not only the freedom of religion, but also various aspects of sexual freedom, such as issues concerned with abortion, contraception, sexual orientation, and the like, as well as issues of equality and free speech, and so on. So the title of this talk is The World of the Framers, a Christian Nation. And let me begin with a story I came across recently in the New York Times, which read as follows. On Sunday, at the Naval Academy Chapel in Annapolis, at a few minutes past 11 a.m., the choir stops singing, and a color guard carrying the American flag strides up the aisle. Below a cobalt blue stained glass window of Jesus, a midshipman dips the American flag before the altar cross. Evangelical Christians in the Navy defend this practice on the ground that it represents the highest Christian traditions of this country. Another Navy officer, however, objected to this practice, stating that the oath that he and others had taken is to protect and to defend the Constitution, not the New Testament. The question I want to ask is whether there is a difference. And in approaching that question, I begin, as do the evangelical Christians who maintain there is not a difference, with the world of the Puritans. Now, when the Puritans first arrived in the New World, they clearly established rigidly theocratic societies. As they declared in 1639 in the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut, the Word of God requires that there should be an orderly and decent government established according to God. Without any ambiguity, they established their churches as the official state religion, which was directly supported by tax revenues and defended by the coercive arm of the state. The laws of the early Puritan colonies were expressly justified by reference to specific biblical passages. The state punished blasphemy and aggressively enforced religious doctrine. Citizenship was tied directly to religious faith, and the Puritan settlements were designed with the expectation that only godly Christians would rule. Invoking that past, modern-day Christian evangelicals often assert that the United States was founded as a Christian nation, but that in recent decades, out-of-control secularists have broken faith with our most fundamental traditions. Nothing, I believe, could be further from the truth. In fact, long before the American Revolution, the Puritan vision of a unified, orthodox religious community had proved unattainable. In the generations leading up to the Revolution of 1776, the American colonies grew dramatically in population, ethnic and religious diversity, economic production, and cultural sophistication. the small, insular, self-selected Puritan communities of the early 17th century were literally blown apart by the forces of change. And as people were released from their traditional social roles, they were made free in new and unexpected ways. Throughout the 18th century, conventional sources of authority were called into question. As the Harvard historian Bernard Bailyn once observed, mid-18th century Americans sought to achieve a profound transformation in their society, their personal lives, their government, and their religion. This transformation was, of course, shaped in large part by the Enlightenment. Under the influence of Enlightenment ideals, the American colonists converted their frustration with overbearing British rule into a bold new conception of freedom, a conception that involved new understandings of God, man, human rights, the state, and history. With the Declaration of Independence, these understandings became a cornerstone of the American political tradition, a tradition that was born in the full illumination of the Enlightenment. Thomas Paine reminded Americans of the Revolutionary era that they had boldly thrown off the prejudices of the old order and had embraced a new, enlightened, more rational conception of man. "We see," he said, "with other eyes, we hear with other ears, and we think with other thoughts than those we formerly used." The ignorance and superstition of the old world, he declared, had finally been expelled, and the mind, once enlightened, cannot again become dark. The United States was conceived not in an age of faith, but in an age of reason. The framers viewed issues of religion and politics through a prism that was highly critical of what they saw as Christianity's historical excesses and superstitions. In fact, the Revolutionary era was a period of serious decline for American Christianity. By the time the framers began drafting the United States Constitution, church membership had dropped to a point that not more than 10% of the people were members of Christian churches. Evangelicalism, as defined by its contemporary exponents, played at most a negligible role in the founding era. Indeed, it's quite striking and certainly no accident that, unlike the fundamental orders of Connecticut, the United States Constitution made no reference whatever to God and cited as its primary source of authority not the Word of God, but we the people. The stated purpose of the Constitution was not to create a government established according to God, not to establish a Christian nation, but to create a secular state. The only reference to religion in the original Constitution prohibited the use of any religious test for holding office, and the First Amendment made clear that there would be no Church of the United States. From the Declaration of Independence through the adoption of the Bill of Rights, no one of any consequence referred to the United States as a Christian nation. One illustration of the profound shift from the fundamental orders of Connecticut to the Constitution of the United States can be seen in the transition in higher education from what was called the old learning to the new learning over the course of the 18th century. The pre-Enlightenment old learning emphasized theological study. At an institution like Harvard, which was Puritan in its origins, 17th century tutors taught students the received truths of the Puritan divines. A central goal of the old learning was to instruct students in biblical interpretation, and students were directed to accept the absolute authority of the Bible as the sole repository of truth. The new learning, which was rooted in the Enlightenment, taught students to question authority, including the authority of the Bible. It taught that there were truths that lay outside the scriptures, truths that could be discerned through careful observation and reason. Much of the intellectual impetus for the new learning derived from the work of Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, and John Locke. Bacon had insisted that reasoned argument must proceed from the concrete data of experience. Newton had demonstrated that the universe was knowable because it was rational. And Locke, whose writings most directly shaped the intellectual and political worldview of 18th century Americans, warned against sacred claims to truth. Almost all the framers were educated in the new learning. And this does not mean that they were anti-Christian. Most of the founding fathers at least occasionally attended church and identified with one or more of the Christian denominations. But as men of the Enlightenment, few of them put much stock in traditional Christianity. Indeed, as we'll see, many of the leaders of the revolutionary generation were not Christians in any traditional sense. They were broad-minded intellectuals who viewed religious passion as divisive and as irrational, and who consistently challenged both publicly and privately the dogmas of traditional Christianity. The most important religious trend of the mid-18th century, the belief in deism or rational religion, had a profound influence on the founding generation. The roots of deism are ancient, but its modern revival can be traced to a series of British writers in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. John Toland, for example, argued that in order to be credible, a religion must be logical, and it must be consistent with the laws of nature. Thomas Wooston challenged the doctrine of miracles, arguing that the New Testament's account of Jesus' miracles was, quote, broken, elliptical, and absurd. And Matthew Tyndale charged that revealed theology was nothing more than wishful thinking. The deists were not atheists. They challenged religious beliefs they could not reconcile with reason, but they accepted the idea of a supreme being. But the deist God was not the Judeo-Christian God who intervenes in human history and who listens to personal prayers. It was rather a more distant being whom the deists referred to as the creator, the first cause, the grand architect, and nature's God. The deists believed that the supreme being who created the universe, including the laws of nature, was a benign God, that the creator had revealed both his existence and his nature in the laws of nature, and that he'd given man the capacity to understand those laws through the exercise of reason. They believed further that the creator had embedded both the meaning of morality and the existence of inalienable human rights within the laws of nature, and that they too could be discerned through the use of reason. Most deists did not accept the divinity of Jesus, the truth of miracles or revelation, or the doctrines of original sin or predestination. They rejected these concepts as antithetical to the dictates of reason, and argued that such doctrines had not only kept mankind in the shackles of superstition and ignorance, but also insulted the majesty and dignity of God. Most deists believed that people had no need to read the Bible, pray, be baptized or circumcised, attend church, or conform to any of what they regarded as the irrational beliefs and practices of Christianity, or indeed of any religion. Of course, there were more and less radical versions of deism. Some deists flatly rejected Christianity. Others regarded themselves as enlightened Christians. To understand our national origins, it's essential to understand that deism had a powerful impact on the colonists. Many of our founding fathers, including Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Ethan Allen, and Gouverneur Morris, were flat-out deists. And many others, such as John Adams, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, James Monroe, and George Washington, were at least partial deists who accepted most elements of the deist critique. The significance of deism for the creation of the United States can hardly be overstated. From roughly 1725 through the end of the 18th century, deistic beliefs played a central role in the framing of the American Republic. Of course, not all of the founding fathers were deists. Many, such as Patrick Henry, Sam Adams, and John Jay, were traditional Christians. But on the whole, the founding generation viewed religion through an Enlightenment lens that was deeply skeptical of Orthodox Christianity. And it's instructive to consider some of those who were, in varying degrees, influenced by deism. And to that end, I'd like to explore with you the beliefs of five key members of the founding generation: Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, George Washington, and Thomas Paine. Franklin was, of course, the embodiment of the American Enlightenment. He had a deep dislike of religious enthusiasm, and in his autobiography, he revealed that at an early age, he'd become a real doubter in many points of our religious doctrine. Revelation, he said, including the Ten Commandments, has no weight with me as such. As Franklin made clear in his autobiography, he was a thorough deist. Franklin dismissed much of Christian doctrine as unintelligible, and was quite critical of how Christianity had affected mankind. He said, "If we look back into history for the character of the present sects in Christianity, we shall find few that have not in their turns been both persecutors and complainers of persecution. The primitive Christians thought persecution extremely wrong in the pagans, but then practiced it on one another. The first Protestants of the Church of England blamed persecution in the Romish Church, but then practiced it upon the Puritans. These found it wrong in the bishops, but fell into the same practice themselves." Only days before his death, in response to an inquiry about his religious beliefs, Franklin replied, "Here is my creed. I believe in one God, the creator of the universe, that he governs the world by his providence, that he ought to be worshipped, that the most acceptable service we can render to him is doing good to his other children. These," he added, "are the fundamental principles of all sound religion." With respect to Jesus, Franklin observed, "I think his system of morals and religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. but I apprehend that over time it has received various corrupting changes. Turning to the question of Jesus' divinity, Franklin Riley concluded, "I have some doubts as to his divinity, though it is a question I do not dogmatize upon, having never studied it, and think it needless to busy myself with it now, when I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble." Like most deists who rejected the doctrines of original sin and predestination, Franklin believed in a deity who delights in man's pursuit of virtuous behavior, which Franklin defined as knowledge of our true interest, that is, of what is best to be done in all the circumstances of human life, in order to arrive at our main end in view, which is happiness. In Franklin's opinion, man achieves happiness both by satisfying his own needs and by promoting the well-being of his fellow man. He believed that for man to pursue his own happiness pleases the Creator, because the truly benevolent deity delights in the happiness of those he's created. Franklin believed that people serve God best not when they obey irrational dogma, but when they perform good works on behalf of humanity. He faulted Christianity for not being, quote, "more productive of good works than I have generally seen it. I mean real good works, works of kindness, charity, mercy, and public spirit, not holiday keeping, sermon reading, or making long prayers filled with flatteries and compliments." In sum, Franklin regarded all religions as more or less interchangeable in their most fundamental tenets, which he believed required men to pursue their own happiness and to treat others with kindness and respect. He regarded Jesus as a wise moral philosopher, but not necessarily as a divine or divinely inspired figure. And he had no particular use for Christian doctrine insofar as it departed from the core teachings of Jesus. A longtime friend despaired that a man of Franklin's general good character and great good influence was such an unbeliever in Christianity. No member of the founding generation embodied America's democratic ideals more than Thomas Jefferson. "The principles of Jefferson," said Lincoln, "are the definitions and axioms of a free society." Like Franklin, Jefferson was a true Enlightenment philosoph. A thoroughgoing skeptic, Jefferson subjected every religious tradition, including his own, to scientific scrutiny. He had little patience for talk of miracles, revelation, or resurrection. Jefferson saw his age as a unique opportunity for man to push back the forces of darkness and to unleash man's reason in order to comprehend the true order of the universe. Jefferson believed that the universe was comprehensible and that in the long run, the application of reason would reveal and explain its mysteries. On the subject of religion, Jefferson cautioned his nephew, Peter Carr, to, quote, "shake off all the fears and prejudices under which weak minds are servilely crouched." He urged Carr to question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear. Like Franklin, Jefferson admired Jesus as a moral philosopher. He wrote John Adams that the moral beliefs espoused by Jesus reflected the most sublime and benevolent code of morals which has ever been offered to man. And on another occasion, he described Jesus' character as the most eloquent that has ever been exhibited to man. Although Jefferson clearly denied Jesus' divinity, he ascribed to him, quote, "every human excellence," and maintained that Jesus himself never claimed any other. But Jefferson insisted that Jesus' teachings had been distorted out of all recognition by a succession of corruptors. He described such doctrines as predestination, the inefficacy of good works, and original sin as demoralizing dogmas, nonsense, dross, distortions, abracadabra, insanity, a hocus-pocus phantasm, and a deliria of crazy imaginings. In a letter to John Davis, Jefferson disdained the, quote, "metaphysical abstractions, maniac ravings, and foggy dreams of Jesus' followers, who," he said, "had so burdened Christianity with absurdities and incomprehensibilities as to drive into infidelity men who had not the time, patience, or opportunities to strip it of its meretricious trappings." Jefferson referred to Christianity as our peculiar superstition and concluded that ridicule was the only rational response to its unintelligible propositions. The clergy, he wrote, were false shepherds and usurpers of the Christian name, who were like scuttlefish, which used darkness to make themselves impenetrable to the eye of a pursuing enemy. Jefferson was not, however, a godless man. Though deeply committed to the separation of church and state and fiercely anti-clerical, he was also a man of deeply felt private religious conviction, who believed in a benign creator whose only revelation to man was made through nature and reason. Like other deists, Jefferson believed that the Creator had endowed man with a moral compass, an innate and natural sense of right and wrong. Man's moral moral sense, or conscience, Jefferson reasoned, is as much a part of man as his leg or his arm. All people, he wrote, have implanted in our breasts a moral instinct and a love of others, which prompts us to feel and to succor their successes, their distresses. Jefferson praised this moral law as the brightest gem with which the human character is studded, and he believed that it was these natural moral dispositions that made self-governance possible. To Jefferson, then, the nature of virtue was neither dependent upon nor to be comprehended through Christian revelation, but was clearly evident in nature and discernible through the exercise of reason. The dogmas of religion, he wrote Matthew Carey, are quite distinct from moral principles, and Jefferson had no difficulty with the proposition that even atheists could be moral. Indeed, Jefferson viewed most claims of religious dogma not as principles of morality, but as sectarian bids for power. As he wrote Thomas Leeper, most dogmas that differ among religions do not instruct us how to live well, but are designed to gain power and support for those who inculcate them. For Jefferson, the fundamental precepts of morality, which he believed were held in common in all religions, were captured by Jesus' maxims, treat others as you would have them treat you, and love thy neighbor as thyself. As Jefferson never tired of saying, the essence of virtue is in doing good to others. Jefferson was, of course, the primary drafter of the Declaration of Independence. And in the light of his views as a deist, and in the light of the similar views held by many of the other signers, it's important to note the precise language of the Declaration. It does not invoke Jesus or Christ or the Father or the Lord or the Almighty or any of the other traditional characterizations of the Christian deity. Rather, it invokes nature's God, the Creator, the Supreme Judge, and the Divine Providence. The Declaration of Independence was a document of the Enlightenment. It was not a Puritan or Methodist or Protestant or Catholic or evangelical Christian statement. It was rather a statement that deeply and intentionally invoked the language of American deism. It was a document of its own time, and it speaks eloquently about what Americans of that time believed. John Adams saw the world as a rather hostile place, both to himself and to the American cause, which was the great passion of his life. None of the founders read more and thought more about law and politics than Adams, and none was more attuned to the hopes and promise of the Enlightenment. Like Jefferson, Adams believed that the original teachings of Jesus were sound, but that they had been corrupted by the various creeds and philosophies that had been grafted onto them. As Adams grew older, he became increasingly suspicious of religious dogma. As he wrote to Benjamin Rush, "There is a germ of religion in human nature so strong that whenever an order of men can persuade the people by flattery or terror that they have salvation at their disposal, there can be no end to fraud, violence, and usurpation." Noting the rise of religious fundamentalism early in the 19th century during the Second Great Awakening, Adams warned that instead of the most enlightened people, I fear we Americans shall soon have the character of the silliest people under heaven. Religion and churchgoing were important to Adams, and to a greater extent than either Franklin or Jefferson, he believed in a personal God. But like other deists, he substituted a simpler, less mysterious form of Christianity for the dogmas he'd inherited from his Puritan forebears. His reading and reflection led him to reject such doctrines as predestination and original sin. The Creator, he declared, has given us reason to find out the truth and the real design and true end of our existence. Though a Congregationalist, Adams more closely identified with Unitarianism. A religious movement that had developed in England in the 17th century, Unitarianism was closely related to deism. Unitarians understood Jesus as a moral teacher rather than as a divine, and rejected the traditional Christian tenets of predestination, original sin, scriptural revelation, and atonement. The chief 18th century proponent of Unitarianism was the English scientist Joseph Priestley. Adams, Franklin, Jefferson, and many other Americans of this era were avid readers of Priestley's works. Reflecting these beliefs, Adams wrote to Jefferson that his religion could be contained in four short words: be just and good. Adams was acutely aware of the need to separate religion from politics. Nothing, he wrote, is more dreaded than the national government meddling with religion. As Adams wrote Benjamin Rush, I mix religion with politics as little as possible. His dissertation of the canon and feudal law, written in 1774, was a sharp attack against the civil and ecclesiastical tyranny of earlier Catholic and Protestant establishments. And in his defense of the American Constitutions, written in 1788, Adams devoted several chapters to condemning the horrors of religious wars, crusades, inquisitions, and pogroms. He warned that given the opportunity, 19th century evangelicals would whip and crop and pillory and roast in America, just as they had earlier in Europe. In 1775, one of the delegates to the Second Continental Congress was a clergyman who wanted Congress to focus on what he called America's Christian identity. Adams wrote his wife Abigail that, as he is the first gentleman of the cloth who has appeared in Congress, I cannot but wish that he may be the last. Mixing the sacred character with that of the statesman is not attended with any good effects. When Adams was president, he signed the 1797 Treaty of Tripoli, which had been unanimously approved by the Senate, and in which the United States emphatically affirmed, quote, the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. 20 years later, Adams wrote to Jefferson, 20 times in the course of my late reading, I've been put upon the point of breaking out, this would be the best of all possible worlds if there were no religion in it. But he then added, without religion, this world would be something not fit to be mentioned in polite company. I mean, hell. This ambivalence reflected Adams' lifelong belief that all of history had proved that the people, unrestrained, tend to be unjust, tyrannical, brutal, barbarous, and cruel. This view of man posed a serious problem for Adams as a political theorist, for like the other founders, he knew that self-governance ultimately depends on the character of the people. No Republican government can last, he observed, unless there is a positive passion for the public good. Given his skepticism about man's tendency to misbehave, he doubted whether the people had the integrity necessary to make the Republican experiment in self-governance successful. As he told Mercy Warren in January 1776, there is so much rascality, so much venality and corruption, so much avarice and ambition, such a rage for profit and commerce among all ranks and degrees of men that the very idea of republicanism seems precarious. Adams rested his hopes for the future on the regenerative effects of Republican government and on the emergence of politicians who could mold the character of the people, extinguishing their follies and vices and inspiring their virtues and their abilities. The American Revolution, he believed, had to reform the culture or it would not succeed. He warned that unless a public-spirited virtue could be inspired into our people, they will not obtain a lasting liberty. It was here that Adams, like many of the founders, believed that religion could play a positive role in helping to shape the people's moral conduct and their ideas about justice, decency, duty, and responsibility. Religion, he believed, could be a source of Republican virtue. But neither Adams nor most of the other founders meant traditional Christianity with all of its complex dogmas and tenets when they invoked religion as the foundation of Republican government. Rather, as Adams wrote Jefferson, the essence of sound religious belief was captured in the phrase, be just and good. And as Jefferson replied, what all agree in is probably right. The vast majority of the founders believed that the principle, be just and good, could play a critical role in nurturing the sort of public-spiritedness that they deemed essential to self-governance. And they believed that some version of what Rousseau called civil religion and what Jefferson referred to as nature's God would be salutary in fostering the spirit of American republicanism. But this was a far cry from endorsing the sanctity of Christian doctrine. Compared with Franklin, Jefferson, and Adams, George Washington was not a particularly learned man. He was a man of affairs rather than a man of ideas. His greatness lay in his character, which left an indelible mark upon the nation. Washington's public conduct epitomized the sort of public-spirited and disinterested Republican integrity that the new nation needed. A man of the Enlightenment, Washington was liberal on matters of religion. He was, in his own words, no bigot myself to any mode of worship. Unlike Jefferson, though, he was not contemptuous of traditional Christianity. He believed that an unseen but benevolent power guided both the universe and human affairs, and he variously referred to this force as providence, the almighty ruler of the universe, the great architect of the universe, and the great disposer of events. Washington was reticent about his own religious beliefs. He paid little attention to religion in his personal life and was not an avid churchgoer. He was neither religiously fervent nor theologically learned. He described his own religious tenets as few and simple. His biographer, Joseph Ellis, observed that at his death, Washington did not think much about heaven or angels. The only place he knew his body was going was into the ground. And as for his soul, its ultimate location was unknowable. He died as a Roman Stoic rather than as a Christian saint. It is not even clear that Washington considered himself a Christian. Although he maintained a connection with the Anglican Church, this was certainly prudent behavior for a cautious political leader. Washington's personal papers, however, offer no evidence that he believed in biblical revelation, eternal life, or Jesus' divinity. In several thousand letters, he never once mentioned Jesus, and the name of Jesus was notably absent from his will. All in all, Washington's practice of Christianity has aptly been characterized as limited and superficial at best. Clergymen who knew Washington bemoaned his skeptical approach to Christianity. The Reverend Dr. Bird Wilson acknowledged that Washington was not a professing Christian, and Bishop William White admitted that no degree of recollection will bring to my mind any fact which would prove General Washington to have been a believer in Christian revelation. Washington has variously and accurately been described as a cool deist, a warm deist, a theistic rationalist, a Stoic, and a Christian deist. As president, Washington was always careful not to invoke Christianity. His official speeches, orders, and other public communications scrupulously reflected his perspective of a deist. His references to religion omitted such phrases as Jesus, Christ, Lord, Father, Redeemer, and Savior, and he invariably edited such terms out of his official documents whenever his subordinates attempted to insert them. Instead, he used such deistic phrases as providence, the supreme being, and the deity. Like Adams, however, Washington believed that some form of religion was useful, both to public morality and republican government. In his farewell address, Washington warned that reason and experience forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in the exclusion of religious principle. Thomas Paine's common sense helped catalyze the colonies and inspire the Declaration of Independence. After the Revolution, Paine returned to England and published The Rights of Man, a forceful defense of republicanism based upon the theory of natural rights. He soon followed up with The Age of Reason, which sharply criticized Christian doctrine and declared that reason, not supernaturalist creeds or dogma, must be man's sole guide in moral and religious matters. In The Age of Reason, Paine announced, "I believe in one God and no more. I believe in the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish Church, by the Roman Church, by the Greek Church, by the Turkish Church, by the Protestant Church, nor by any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church." Paine maintained that the religion of deism is superior to the Christian religion because it is free from those invented and torturing articles that shock our reason. Deism's creed, he wrote, is purely and sublimely simple. It believes in God and there it rests. It honors reason as the choicest gift of God to man and the faculty by which he is enabled to contemplate the power, wisdom, and goodness of the Creator displayed in the creation. It avoids all presumptuous beliefs and rejects, as the fabulous inventions of men, all books pretending to revelation. Paine was merciless in his attack on Christian doctrine. He denied that, quote, the Almighty ever did communicate anything to man by any mode of speech, in any language, or by any kind of vision. He characterized Christianity as a fable, which for absurdity and extravagance is not exceeded by anything that is to be found in the mythology of the ancients. He castigated the Bible as a fraud, pointed out its internal contradictions, contrasted its teachings with the findings of science, and harangued it for its immorality. It is, he charged, a book of lies, wickedness, and blasphemy. For what could be more blasphemous than to ascribe the wickedness of man to the orders of the Almighty? Paine derided Christianity's acceptance of miracles as ignorant, and he charged that the postulation of miraculous interventions by God degrades him to the character of a showman, who plays tricks to amuse and to make the people stare in wonder. Paine maintained that by demanding unquestioning belief in the miraculous revelation, insisting that believers accept superstition as truth, and denying believers the right to criticize religious dogma, Christianity had fundamentally undermined the freedom of conscience and encouraged intolerance and persecution. Paine's works, Common Sense, The Rights of Man, and The Age of Reason, became the three most widely read political tracts of the 18th century. Paine was the greatest spokesman of popular deism, and to Orthodox American Christians, he was a villain and an infidel. Indeed, throughout the second half of the 18th century, Orthodox Christianity worried deeply about the impact of deism. As I already noted, the Revolutionary Era was a period of decline for American Christianity, and the rise of deism was seen as a continuing threat. By the latter years of the 18th century, colleges like Yale, William and Mary, and Princeton had become hotbeds of deism, and even staid Puritan Harvard had become enmeshed in free thought. The Christian establishment responded with a vengeance. As early as 1759, Ezra Stiles warned that deism has got such head that it is necessary to conquer and demolish it. 30 years later, Timothy Dwight, the president of Yale, published a biting anti-deist work, The Triumph of Infidelity. And Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was literally put to the torch at Harvard because of its uncomplimentary interpretation of early Christianity. In 1784, Ethan Allen, the leader of the Green Mountain Boys and the hero of the Battle of Ticonderoga, published a book-length argument for deism. This work, Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, was furiously condemned by the clergy. Timothy Dwight accused Allen of championing Satan's cause. Ezra Stiles charged that Allen was profane and impious. And the Reverend Nathan Perkins called him one of the wickedest men that has ever walked this guilty globe. Did the framers intend the United States to be a Christian nation? Clearly, they did not. The Declaration of Independence marked a fundamental shift in our history. Before 1776, public expressions of faith in the colonies were often overtly Christian. But in declaring themselves independent of Britain, the American founders invoked the language and spirit of the Enlightenment. The Declaration was signed by men of widely diverse religious beliefs, ranging from traditional Christians to committed deists. But in acknowledging nature's God, the Creator, and divine providence, the Declaration clearly and quite consciously eschewed any invocation of Christian doctrine. At the same time, and as we've seen, the framers were acutely aware that a republican form of government presupposes certain qualities of civic virtue among the people. And many believed that there was a direct link between religion and civic virtue. This was certainly true of those who held traditional religious beliefs. Phillips Payson, for example, an influential Congregationalist minister, maintained that religion is of the highest importance to civil society, as it keeps alive the best sense of moral obligation. John Witherspoon, a Presbyterian clergyman and a signer of the Declaration, warned that even a good form of government cannot protect the people against their natural profligacy and corruption unless religion informs their values. Benjamin Rush wrote that for the new nation to succeed, Americans would have to adhere to the religious principles and moral habits of the first settlers. Rush expressed his fear that attempts to produce political happiness by the solitary influence of human reason will be fruitless. Although conceding that reason produces great and popular truths, he cautioned that it affords motives too feeble to induce mankind to act agreeably to them. Religion, on the other hand, he argued, unfolds the same truths and accompanies them with motives, agreeable, powerful, and irresistible. Even those founders who were not committed to the religious principles of the first settlers generally agreed that religion could help to foster republican virtue. In a letter to Rush, John Adams opined that religion and virtue are the necessary foundations of republicanism and of all free government. And in a letter to Abigail Adams, he noted, "Statesmen may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand." Alexander Hamilton also believed that religion could promote civic virtue. Hamilton reasoned that liberty depends upon morality and that morality must fall without religion, because religion alone, he said, can curb the impetuous passions of man and confine him within the bounds of social duty. Even Benjamin Franklin thought that religion had a role to play in sustaining the morals of ordinary citizens. In a letter admonishing a young writer who'd made a particularly strident attack on religion, Franklin cautioned, "You yourself may find it easy to live a virtuous life without the assistance afforded by religion, you possessing a strength of resolution sufficient to enable you to resist common temptations. But think how great a proportion of mankind consists of weak and ignorant men and women, who have need of the motives of religion to restrain them from vice, to support their virtue, and to retain them in the practice of it till it becomes habitual. If men are so wicked as we now see them with religion, what would they be if without it?" Not all of the founders believed that religion was necessary for an orderly and virtuous republican society. Jefferson, for example, believed that religion was not essential for moral conduct. But even Jefferson acknowledged that the liberties of a nation are more secure when the people see them as the gift of the Creator. In light of these views, it should be evident that the framers' treatment of religion in the Constitution was not an act of irreverence. Rather, the framers recognized that religion could and should play a role in helping to preserve the civil morality necessary for democracy. But the framers drew a sharp distinction in their understanding of the proper relation between religion and law in a free society. They valued religion, but given their knowledge of the religious strife that had plagued man's history and their appreciation of the importance to individual liberty of both freedom of and freedom from religion, they saw the wisdom of distinguishing between private and public religion. In churches, temples, and homes, anyone could believe and practice whatever he wished. But in the public business of the nation, it was essential for the government to speak of religion in a way that was unifying, not divisive. Now, you may wonder, whatever happened to deism? Well, with the French Revolution following hard on the heels of the American Revolution, it seemed for a moment that the world was on the cusp of a new era of individual liberty, based on a commitment to human reason. But as the violence of the French Revolution collapsed into a fearsome reign of terror, Americans were shocked to see self-styled rationalists transformed into a new breed of tyrant, ideological rather than religious in nature. As the guillotine became the public image of the French Revolution, the terror came to be linked in popular opinion with the religious skepticism of the Enlightenment. Doubt and reaction soon set in everywhere, and the Enlightenment project began to be viewed with increasing suspicion and alarm. With the excesses of the French Revolution, people increasingly became fearful of the possible consequences of a less directive religious culture, and for many, the appeal of a more distant and impersonal deity began to cool. With the anxieties created by the French Revolution compounded by the dramatic social dislocations caused by early 19th century immigration, urbanization, and industrialization, people increasingly longed for a more personal relationship with the divine. They wanted a God who was responsive to the supplications, fears, insecurities, and hopes of humanity. The backlash in both Europe and America pushed the rationalism of the 18th century off center stage, and at the turn of the 19th century, the Second Great Awakening burst upon the United States as a wave of conservatism and religiosity swept the nation. Deism was simply overwhelmed by the surge of Christian revivalism. By the end of his life in 1826, Thomas Jefferson could look back with a sense of despair, because in his view, American society was going backward. Instead of becoming more enlightened, Americans now seemed to be returning, he said, to the superstitions of the past. The ordinary people in whom Jefferson had placed such confidence now seemed to him less rational than they had been at the time of the Revolution. And what, you might ask, is the point of all this? Well, it is, I think, simply this, that whether you fancy yourself an originalist or an interpretivist, a champion of a living constitution or a dead hand, when you puzzle over the meaning of the Establishment Clause, the Free Exercise Clause, the Ninth Amendment, the Due Process Clause, or the Free Speech Clause, when you consider whether the Constitution allows the government to have faith-based initiatives, deny homosexuals the right to marry, prohibit obscenity, forbid abortion, ban stem cell research, teach creationism, or dip the flag to Jesus, it helps to know the truth about the framers, about what they believed, and about what they aspired to when they created this nation. Thank you. Good. Questions, comments? Yes.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on the frequency and content of any prayers that were offered during the constitutional conventions and which of the framers participated or instituted these prayers. I've heard of them, but I really don't know.
During the constitutional convention, there was one moment when the convention was stuck, and Benjamin Franklin, of all people, then in his dotage, I should say, suggested a prayer. A suggestion that was met with complete silence and rejected by the convention. And so there was no prayer actually stated or agreed to within the Constitutional Convention itself. After the Constitution was enacted, in the first several decades, there was constant give and take about the question of whether it was appropriate for the nation, for example, to recognize declarations of thanksgiving, or whether it was appropriate to commence meetings of the Congress with prayers. And some presidents, like Washington, issued declarations of thanksgiving. Others, like Jefferson and Madison, refused to do so. So there was an ambiguity and disagreement about whether those kinds of symbolic statements were appropriate. Madison went so far as president to veto even legislation that would have funded neutrally activities that included religious activity. But Adams was more supportive of that. But throughout the first five or six terms, the general view was certainly one reflected in what I've stated here, which was an effort within the context of their times to keep government quite separate from religion. Now, it's important to note that in these times, Protestantism was so ever present in day-to-day life that the line between law and some aspects of Protestantism was almost invisible to the members of the generation. So, let's see, what good examples. Mail delivery, for example, was banned on, was allowed on Sundays. And in the early 19th century, movement was made to ban mail delivery on Sunday by the government because it was thought to be unseemly. And it took several decades during the Second Great Awakening before the government was willing to ban Sunday mail delivery. But before that, Congress basically trying to enforce the idea of separation refused to adopt the practice of no mail on Sundays. That didn't currently play
in. Given Jefferson the Deist's recognition of growing religion among society, why did he also then want revision of the Constitution or a rewriting of the Constitution with each generation?
Well, first of all, he said that early on, before this happened. But in any event, Jefferson's basic point of view was he rejected the idea of the dead hand. So his view is that a Constitution is an agreement that a given generation makes for itself, but it has no moral authority to bind future generations. So I don't think Jefferson particularly believed that if future generations made their own constitutions, they would necessarily be better or worse by his lights. His thought was simply that in terms of legitimacy, that one generation didn't have a moral authority to bind a subsequent generation. So I don't think his view would have been that if we did have a new constitutional convention every 20 years, that would necessarily produce better or worse law. I think Jefferson hoped for progress. By the time he died, he'd come to bemoan that. But in any event, his view was one about legitimacy. You know, he was very focused on this question of why can people writing a document in the late 18th century control what people do in the 21st century.
So he found legitimacy more important than his own deist beliefs versus religious beliefs, then?
Well, I don't think this question about redoing the Constitution had anything to do with his religious beliefs. I mean, I think it just had to do with his notion of political legitimacy and the sense that, you know, we should all govern ourselves, and that includes each generation writing its own constitution.
I'm curious, since most originalists would say, well, we don't really care about the intentions of the founders, what matters was the original public understanding, I'm wondering how you can respond to an argument that 18th century American intellectuals were no more representative of the average American's religious beliefs than they are today, and that therefore what we need to look at is how the average American understood the doctrine that they were ratifying, and they may have been swept up in the First Great Awakening and things that these intellectuals were not really sympathetic to, and they may have understood the document in very different religious terms than the founders themselves.
Right, so okay, first of all, I'm not that kind of originalist at all, but putting myself in that role, I think what they would find is that, as I said, only 10% of people were affiliated with the Christian church by the 1780s. So during the First Great Awakening, 30 years earlier, there was a much greater movement of Christian revivalism, but that had passed. And I can't say I know what the average person on the street thought of with respect to these issues. But what's clear is that they were not evangelicals. And they didn't believe that. And again, you know, religion was established in 11 of the 13 states at the time that the Constitution was adopted. So the idea in each state about having their own religion, the majority religion in each state, connected with public authority, was still accepted in the vast majority of the states at that time, although it was in the process of disappearing. So I don't think that they would have had quite the same resistance to, quite the same approach to non-establishment at the state level that the government did at the national level. But this was not due to any particular religious fervor. It was largely due to the fact that it was the law, had been the law from the beginning, and it takes a long time to change the law. And it all did get changed over the next 25 years. So the bottom line is, I think if you looked at what the average person on the street believed, deism was increasingly popular by the late 18th century. I think the main view among people was simply religion wasn't an important part of their lives, one way or the other. They were not even as thoughtful about religion as deists, who were intellectuals and quite thoughtful about it, nor were they, however, living their lives according to any particular belief in Christianity.
About this statement that 10% of the population wasn't related to Christianity, could you explain a little bit about what that means? Could it mean official membership in a church? If so, did the church have to accept this member, or would it have to pay for a pew, or had to refuse to become popular in the late 18th century? And if you were not in favor of the established church in your state, to what extent would you have had access to your preferred church, whatever?
Yeah, the data on this is based upon, obviously, historical records of church membership and church attendance. And the numbers range from under 10% to about 15 or 17%. But the most reliable figure, according to the literature, is about 10%. And I think it's based on the combination of formal affiliation and attendance. And beyond that, I can't vouch for the numbers, but they seem to be pretty well respected among people who are historians of this field.
But do you know what degree of active affiliation this represents?
I think it includes regular church attendance. Yeah.
So I was wondering, since initially there was such a close connection between religious study and secular study, just education in general, when that connection broke down, do you think there was still a pretty strong sense among the framers that education, at least, if not religious education, secular education, should be necessary to participation in political life, whether it's voting or running for office? So not a religious test, but an education test to run for office and to vote and so forth. Would they have supported that, or just a universal right to vote, political participation?
Well, they didn't believe in either. I mean, they didn't believe in universal franchise, certainly. But they also, I'm not aware of any formal legal standards that required education to be elected to public office. I mean, initially they, that is the Jeffersons and Adamses and so on, assumed that and hoped that the people who would be elected to hold positions of responsibility would be people like them. That is, people who, in their own view, were public-spirited, who were interested in the public good, did not have their own self-interest at stake, who understood the necessity to look out for the whole rather than for individual self-interest. And they were generally appalled by what they saw in the states between their Declaration of Independence and the time the Constitution was enacted. That is, they were appalled by the extent to which self-interest had run rampant in the electorate and that the quality of state elected representatives. So they were very concerned by the time the Constitution was enacted about whether this whole notion of republicanism would actually work. But they did, and there's a lot of talk actually about education being important to the success of republicanism. But at least in the first iteration, they kind of assumed that the people who would run things would be like them. They'd be educated, they'd have the time, they'd basically be kind of wealthy, and they saw themselves, of course, as being disinterested and appropriate governors. Quickly, they discovered that the people didn't necessarily think they were the right people to be their leaders, and this caused considerable dismay. But yes, I mean, Franklin, for example, and Adams both very distinctly talked about education as important to the operation of self-governance.
It seems clear, I think almost everyone in this room would agree, that central Christian tenets such as Jesus' divinity and predestination were not a major part of the founding of this country. However, it seems that every person you mentioned, either explicitly or implicitly, perhaps with the exception of Thomas Paine, really put a lot of stock in the Christian philosophy. So if I'm arguing about stem cell research or abortion, gay marriage with someone who is invoking the idea that this nation was founded on Christian principles, I mean, how do they not win that argument if the Christian philosophy was such an important part? It seems like everyone you mentioned seemed to think it was a great philosophy. I mean, why is the distinction important?
Well, but again, the philosophy I think that most of the deists embraced was at this very high level of generality, kind of the golden rule. And it did not include specific tenets that might be invoked in debates over issues like abortion or gay marriage or stem cell research and the like. I think the question they would ask themselves about those issues is not what is the Christian position on these issues, but what does be just and good require? And wouldn't be interested in what the Christian position on those issues were, and would regard appeals to the Christian position as illegitimate to political decision making. And so I think that's very hard to implement in practice, but I think as an ideal, that's where they were headed. That their sense was that what they regarded as civic religion was essentially this notion of the golden rule. They attributed that to Christianity. They thought that was great, and that's completely consistent with and should drive republicanism. But beyond that, I think they basically thought you should be thinking about what it is to be good and kind and to respect your fellow citizen rather than appealing to religious sources to resolve specific disputes.
I'm not familiar when the first American currency was printed, but how do you construe the reference to God and the dollar?
It came much later. I don't remember exactly when it came, but it came much later. And I mean, the world changed after 1800. After 1800, with the Second Great Awakening, then the battle between this new new Christian revivalism and the idea of separation was put under enormous strain. And that's when you had issues about Sunday mail delivery, and you had efforts to put in God We Trust on dollars and on money, and the efforts to prosecute blasphemy became much more aggressive again. But that's already past the world of the framers. And those changes very definitely took place, and we inherit a world. And part of the point I want to make is most Americans kind of think that the world of the framers was the world of the early 19th century, and they're not. There's a dramatic change in the world, as both Adams and Jefferson commented to their regret. And so if we attribute to the framers the world of the Second Great Awakening, we're making a terrible mistake about what that world actually was. Second Great Awakening was about Christian revivalism and evangelicalism, and it was a powerful shift in American culture. But it was not the culture that existed 30 years earlier.
I was curious, what is your idea in terms of what role federalism might play in this idea that the national government can't do certain things? So national government is not going to have anything to do with religion, but the states can do what they want.
So obviously the framers of the First Amendment were acting out of their understanding of federalism. And although Madison wanted the equivalent of the First Amendment to bind the states, the Constitutional Convention rejected that and felt that it would be overbearing of the federal government to be dictating to the states, particularly at a time when 11 of the states had established churches. And so his effort to get the Congress in the Constitutional Convention to get the first Congress, because it was actually the first Congress that adopted the Bill of Rights, not the Constitutional Convention. His effort to get the first Congress to adopt the equivalent of religious freedom at the state level was rejected. So they were clearly understanding that freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom from regional search and seizures, those were rights against the federal government only. And the states were free to do whatever they pleased with respect to any of those issues, insofar as the federal constitution was concerned. Now, insofar as what they thought was right, I think the same arguments that they basically invoked about non-establishment as a matter of principle, they would have invoked in the states about getting rid of the established churches, and again, they were all gotten rid of over the next several decades. But there was a critical difference, and that's that at the federal level, you didn't have a single church that had enough power to become established as a single Methodist church or Baptist church or Congregationalist church. And therefore, all of them were kind of nervous about the possibility of an establishment ever coming into being because they didn't know what groups would get together and would try to establish something that may be disadvantageous to them. So there was particular support for the non-establishment in the federal constitution because it wasn't clear who, if anyone, would wind up getting control of the federal government in terms of being able to use it to dictate religious belief at the national level. Whereas in the states, you already had establishments in 11 states, and they knew who the majority was, and there was a majority in each state, and that was reflected in who basically controlled the established church. So the point is, part of the ability to enact the Establishment Clause in the federal government was the product of principle, which would have been applied by many of the framers neutrally in the states if they could have implemented it. And part of it was the product of political reality that it was fairly easy to adopt non-establishment at the federal level because all the sects were nervous about who would get to do the establishing if there was a national establishment. Does that answer your question? But their basic view is that state governments had establishments and there was nothing in the federal constitution and nothing they would do at that time that would interfere with that. Now, constitutionally, of course, the 14th Amendment has been understood to have changed that. and to have essentially made the most of the guarantees in the Bill of Rights, including the religion clauses, applicable to the states. But that's a development that occurs obviously many years later. But the framers themselves of the original First Amendment did not have any expectation that it would interfere with the freedom of the states to do what they wanted with respect to their own citizens in terms of religion.
I'm amazed at the size of the change that you're describing that went on, I guess, at the beginning of the 19th century, where we went from this fairly skeptical, rational society to this one where we're completely saturated with Protestantism. And I just wanted to make clear, or ask you to clarify, what caused that change, if it was, in fact.
Well, you know, asking what causes a social change like that is a very, you know, it's a difficult question, not one lawyers have any particular comparative advantage on. But when I look at historians and sociologists and so on, what they say is it was basically a combination of several factors. One of them was the reaction to the French Revolution, which was very powerful, which scared the hell out of a lot of people in terms of where are we headed and are we following them off the same cliff. So that was a powerful factor. The second one was the enormous disruption in American society that was brought about by immigration and urbanization movement in the early 19th century. It was a period of rapid transformation of society and families breaking up and uncertainty and leading people to want something that they could latch onto. And the third factor was probably really just the coincidence of having a group of individuals who were extraordinarily effective revivalist preachers. Who managed to sort of capture the moment. And again, I don't want to overstate the effect of this. I mean, I think that even at its height, the Second Great Awakening didn't involve more than maybe 20 or 30% of the American people. But that's a lot of people to suddenly be moving in a certain direction at the same time. And it had a large impact on, as I say, issues like blasphemy and putting in God We Trust and stuff like that on the coins and on Sunday mail deliveries and all those issues. That's a huge political block, and it became a very active and powerful political block between 1800 and roughly 1840. Okay, thank you very much.